Hello, and welcome to JK It's Magic, a bi-weekly podcast in which two bookish besties read YA fantasy through a critical lens. Why? Because critique is our fangirl love language, and because talking about books is pretty magical. I'm Jessie.
And I'm Kelly.
And today, we're finally discussing A Court of Thorns and Roses by Sarah J. Maas. ACOTAR is a retelling of Beauty and the Beast with deadly fairies and the super badass Feyre, who enters into a bargain with Tamlin after killing his friend, but really his servant, and fairy Andress. We're going to work really hard to talk about this book without spoilers for the other books in the series. We'll have a special spoiler-filled segment at the end for those who have finished the series.
What did you think? Initial reactions?
I forgot that this book was a little bit boring in the middle, but once we get to Calamai, the book really picks up the pace and the world building is absolutely fantastic. Part of the reason I love this book is because it sets up things so perfectly for the next book, which is my favorite book in the series. This is my third read of the book, and I didn't realize how much it hints towards what happens in the books that follow. So it was fun to reread it. What about you?
This is one of my favorite series of all time, actually. Of course, it's me, right? So I have some issues with the books and the series, and we're going to talk about those. That's the whole point of our like hashtag critically reading method for this podcast. But nevertheless, Maas. Is there any way to know?
I don't know. We could have looked it up before.
Yeah, we could have.
I think it is Maas.
We didn't. Maas is, I think, a masterful storyteller. And Feyre is such a well-crafted character. Also, on a more personal note, I found this series along and Throne of Glass about a year ago when I was really wanting to escape my life for a lot of reasons that I won't go into right here. But suffice it to say that I'm just like grateful beyond words for this series and for these books. And this is the first time I'm rereading it, actually. So I'm excited to discuss them with my bestie.
Yay.
Bestie appreciation.
Time to talk about all things world building in Through the Wardrobe.
The world building in this series is such a slow burn, but it's totally worth it. Because as the reader, we get Feyre's perspective, her first-person viewpoint. We gradually get more and more information as she gets more information. And I just think that's a really effective way to introduce a world.
Yeah, I think I really like it because we don't get like an info dump of like, here are all the kinds of fairies. Here's Prithian. Here's the mortal realm. Like all these different things. So I feel like it's never overwhelming. Like there's never a time where we're learning about the different types of fairies and I feel like, whoa, this is too much information for me at one time. I'm not going to remember what these, like the difference between the Adder and the Nagah and the Bogey are. So I really appreciate slowly learning the things along with Feyre. It was really great.
There were a few info dumps, but they were really discreet and small mm-hmm. and they built on one another. So right. The most obvious one I'm thinking of is the Surreal.
Right. And then the one with Alice.
Exactly.
When she's explaining everything with Amarantha.
Right. But those made sense in the context of the larger narrative. So
right.
It didn't feel like, oh, the author needs to sit the reader down and tell them what's happening so they can figure it, like, so they can actually follow the story.
Right. And I think it's also good because we don't get, like, all of our information about the fairies through exposition, like, through Feyre's inner thoughts. It makes it a lot more conversational. And I know it's kind of a tell and not showing, but I feel like because it's through conversation and it feels natural, it's a better way to, like, give us that information.
Mm-hmm.
Something I found really cool, I did a little research, just the smallest amount.
Get it, Hermione?
I know. But in Irish folklore, ashwood was used to ward off fairies. So I thought that was really cool that in the story that they use ash arrows, but that was what was used like that would protect the humans from the fairies. It was like the one thing that could kill them. And I really thought that was cool.
And ash knives at the end.
Oh, yeah. I forgot those were knives. But I just picture them as arrows every time. I don't know why. There's also a wall separating two groups of beings in this story. It's a huge part of this story and the books that follow. And I have really mixed feelings about this because throughout human history and in our current trash fire of a political climate, walls are not a good thing and they lead to a kind of isolationism that I do not believe in. But on the other hand, the wall is meant to protect the humans who are the weaker of the two beings from being preyed on by the fairies. So I didn't really know how to feel about the wall. It made me feel icky, but at the same time, I get it.
It's like a stopgap solution. It's like a Band-Aid over an internal bleed. It actually doesn't fix any of the like super entrenched ideological problems, prejudices, biases. Right. It does nothing to fix them. You just like separate them out. So instead of like talking across difference and healing shit, you just put a wall in between it so you don't have to deal with it.
Yeah. And the fairies are still coming through the wall. So it's obviously not super effective. But anyways.
But I agree with you that there is a huge power differential.
Right.
So it's not the same as this like garbage wall talk we're getting right now.
Yeah. I think it made me feel a little worse because we also talk about a wall, like just the wall. Like it's, I don't know.
It's just called the wall.
Yeah.
And so the wall is so charged right now for both of us.
Yeah. And I even think of like the Berlin Wall, you know, so like walls are just not good things. We don't need them except to construct houses.
They're not actual solutions.
No, it helps nothing. And it's not helping in this book either. So yeah, no walls. No thanks.
No ban, no wall.
No ban, no wall.
Wands out. Now we're going to talk about all things magic. Humans know that they are at a disadvantage. This is ingrained in the stories that the human children hear growing up. And so there's a market for magical protection in the form of trinkets. So we see iron bracelets, different people having different types of iron accessories, basically, and also the carvings around the cabin door.
Yeah, I never thought about it, but it's kind of like people selling like, what was it like during the like crusades or whatever, selling like pieces of like religious relics kind of.
Right.
But they're not in any way helpful.
And they're also not connected to religion in the same way that a relic is.
No. Yeah, that's so true. Yeah. The religion in this book is kind of interesting because you see like Feyre talks about how the humans have forgotten the mortal gods and like she doesn't know anything about the fairy gods, and then we learn about the cauldron, but even that, there's not really like a huge aspect of religion, especially not in this book.
Calanmai encapsulates how fey magic works. So there's an exchange with the earth, and that insinuates that balance is important, so that's where the fey actually get their magic. It's this sort of exchange. But the ritualized sex, the whole hunter and maiden thing just like didn't land for me. And that's not because it's a guy taking his pick of women, like that's gross enough, of course, but the cisgenderedness of it all. It's fine if sex is a spiritual experience, and I know it was part in more like non-Judeo-Christian religions, especially like pagan traditions from Europe, for example. And it's fine if the like sex is part of a spiritual practice and is ritualized in some way, but describing the entire magical system in these books as hinging upon one annual instance of explicitly heterosexual penis and vagina sex strikes me as transphobic.
Yeah.
And I just am convinced, and I like believe that magic has to exist outside of the cisgender paradigm.
Right. And I wonder if some of that has to do with more of the spring court and how they view magic as opposed to like magic in the fairy world in general. Because I think either Lucien or Tamlin say something about how there are these rituals in the other courts as well. And we don't see anything in those courts, but I wonder if they have different ways of like renewing the magic of their world other than through this super hetero sex ritual.
That's so generous of you. Again, you surprise me every episode. I don't know why I'm so surprised.
Because I'm not very generous in real life with like my opinions of people and things. I get it.
I don't find that convincing though, because we have a bunch of high lords.
Right.
Like the patriarchal setup of the A, courts of Prithian, and then B, because power and magic is specifically tied to who rules the court, mm-hmm. and all those are like gendered male.
Right.
This book really made me think about how magic is power. That sounds like asinine and simple to say, but magic is a way to visualize the violation of consent. So, for example, glamoring or making unfair bargains or keeping someone still. We see Feyre being kept still a lot of the time by magic, like invisible hands, it feels like to her. And the first time Feyre experiences consensual magic is when in the field with Tamlin, when he like gives her the ability to see and hear like the Fey do.
I think I wrote down in my notes somewhere that Tamlin never asks for consent about anything, but I'm glad that you pointed this out because I forgot about it. But yeah, I think it's something we didn't actually talk about when we talked about the Cruel Prince, was how glamoring is a way of like forcing people to see your see the world in the way that you want them to view it. And I do not like it.
It strips people of agency.
Right. Yeah. And it's a violation. But the fairies don't seem to be concerned with that at all. It's really frustrating.
Or it just seems normal to them.
Yes. Because they seem to be doing it all the time. To each other, to whoever. They don't care.
Another part about the magical system that I thought was interesting is when we get this little snippet of information that Nesta can't be glamored. So clearly, fey magic doesn't have the same effect on all humans. So I was right. curious if maybe some humans build up like almost an immunity or a tolerance.
Well, and I think we're supposed to think that Nesta can't be glamored because of how strong-willed she is, which is interesting because Feyre is so stubborn. And for Nesta to be even more stubborn and like hard-headed than Feyre really says something about Nesta. She is a character that I love and hate all at once, but I'm like, oh yeah,
which is the sign of a good character and good writing and good character building.
I know I hate her for reasons I can't talk about right now, but for this book alone, like, she is a very strong, like, confident, sure of herself woman, and she's like willing to make sacrifices for her family and like tell Feyre to go take care of Tamlin, I'll take care of things here. And I really like that about Nesta. I'm proud of her.
I don't know. Yeah. Book one gives you a lot of reasons to not like Nesta because she's so mean.
I know. I have a thing for the mean characters. I really like them. Even in like Downton Abbey, I love Mary. I'm like, yeah, whatever her other sister is, like, she's always so sad and mopey. And I'm like, yeah, fuck her. I like the mean ones. Wands away. Now we're going to talk about conflict, villains, and good versus evil in our segment, Get Me Kylo Ren. Amarantha.
Whoa. She's like the epitome of evil.
I thought it was cool to have a female villain, but she's more of a presence throughout the story, and we don't really see much of her villainy until the end. And then later in Akamath, we get like a bigger picture of what her villainy was like, so we don't get that here. But man, she is wild.
Talk about like strong female characters.
Yeah, yeah.
But one thing that struck me when I was thinking about the book before our recording is that Amarantha gets her power, a sense to power, through trickery. Mm-hmm. And that struck me as a very gendered dynamic, a very gendered picture of how women get power. I mean, yeah, she is brutal and kills everyone too.
Right.
But the main tools in her arsenal are making people like her and trust her, right, and then betraying them. So it seems very much like you get the story of the Malinche in like the conquest of Mexico, mm-hmm, for example. What is now Mexico? Right. Mexico then. But the like traitorous woman, mm-hmm, who helps the colonizer.
Oh.
So I don't know. This like traitor, this trickery dynamic, I think, is pretty gendered.
Right. And I don't think this is a spoiler really, because I know we find out in the next book, but it doesn't matter really. But we find out that Amarantha like put something in like at the party in a drink that everyone has, and even like poisoning is depicted as like a feminine way of like killing people.
Right. Because it's not upfront. It's right. Not like transparent and honest.
Mm-hmm. Maybe that's why I like Nesta, because she's like, I'm not going to stab you in the back. I will do it to your face.
Also, Amarantha is obsessed with torture and domination and asserting her power and diminishing that of others. As in, she literally keeps the vast majority of the High Lord's power locked away. I was reading about this and I'm like, but like where? In a broom cupboard or something? Like how? I guess that's more of a magic question.
But right.
I didn't have the answer.
It's a good question though, because at one point in ACOTAR, someone says something about how she can't access all the power she's taken, but I don't know why.
Is there like a magic vault?
Are all of the High Lords that she took the power from, are all of their hearts turned to stone? Is it just Tamlin? I'm very confused right now. I don't know either. Maybe it doesn't matter.
Listeners, Just as one does not simply walk into Mordor, one does not simply read fantasy without talking about representations of race, class, and gender, and other stuff. This is our segment about power and bodies and how they relate. We're going to start off with gender this time, and I'll start by saying it was 1,000% a gender binary in this book.
Yes, and I don't think we see anything different in the books to come.
In the series in general, and not even in Throne of Glass, I don't think.
No.
Yeah, that's not impressive, but there's a lot of other interesting things to talk
about. I really like the depictions of Nesta, Elaine, and Feyre as a sort of like spectrum of what we see as like classic femininity. We really get like, I guess Feyre would be considered, and I don't like this term, I guess she would be like the most masculine of the three because she's the one hunting and protecting her family and doing like, she's the one doing all the work for the family.
The provider figure.
Yeah, exactly. Literally getting the food for everyone. And then Elaine is like on the opposite side of that. Like she tends to the garden. She wants to look pretty and get married and, you know, do the whole thing. And then Nesta's somewhere in the middle. I don't actually know where to put Nesta.
I don't even know if Nesta is on the spectrum. I don't, she's just an outlier to me.
Maybe it's why I love her. But I thought it was cool to see like three very different people within one family. Like,
absolutely. And they both have their, not both, they all have their strengths. And one thing that I kind of took issue with a little bit is the Elaine tends to see like the good in things, but she's also almost depicted as like an oblivious airhead, which I don't think that being empathetic and compassionate should automatically be associated with ignorance.
I didn't really think about that. Yeah, she does seem, which is kind of funny when you think about how Feyre is the one who actually like didn't get any schooling. She can't read, and still Elaine is seen as like the dumb one. Yeah, it's not cool.
Nesta is infuriating. I have to talk about Nesta. I have to. But as someone who has trouble setting boundaries, myself, Nesta is hashtag goals. Feyre says this about Nesta, quote, Nesta had put up such strong walls of steel and iron and ashwood that even a High Lord's magic couldn't pierce them. It's on page 264. And of course, creating boundaries that are in alignment and allow a person to do less harm while also protecting themselves at the same time is obviously the ultimate objective. But personally, I could use a little Nesta energy to call upon when I'm trying to set boundaries from time to time.
Maybe that's why I like Nesta so much, because I'm like, she knows what she wants. She knows what she doesn't want. And if she doesn't want it, she's like, fuck off. Like, I'm not doing that. I don't want it. Even she's like, I decided not to marry that dude. And like, there's no question about it. She's not going to do it. She's real mean, but I'm like, whatever, it's fine. We get a female mercenary. And I thought that was cool because I guess we don't really see that in books very often or in TV shows or in anything. It's always some dude who you hire.
And I like how it just showed up. It wasn't a thing.
Yeah. And no one like questioned that she could have fought off and killed a fairy. That was really cool. It was the queens from the mortal world that ended the war with the Fae, and Feyre is in charge and the protector of her household. Possible that the mortal lands are more matriarchal than, obviously, the like Prithian is not at all.
I hadn't thought about this, but it's a good point, because we do get this juxtaposition of the High Lord business with all of the mortal queens, which we learn about later. But yeah, I think you're onto something.
I don't think this is a spoiler, but none of the high queens or the queens from the mortal world seem to have like husbands or children.
That's a good point.
Maybe they just all have consorts, which I'm like, good for you.
Multiple ones. Go for it.
Multiple, all the consorts.
Or not just husbands. Could be partners in general.
Yeah, I thought that was really cool. Ladies in charge. Okay, I want to talk about Tamlin and Rhysand a little bit. And there's a lot that I can't say, but there are some things that I can. So we see very different depictions of masculinity in this story. I'm not going to include Lucien in this, just Rhysand and Tamlin. Rhysand is meant to be the opposite of Tamlin in so many ways. Tamlin is described as bulky and very muscular, where Rhysand is described as like, I don't know, trim, Svelte, whatever. Tamlin hulks around and Rhysand, like, they literally say the word saunters into rooms. Tamlin is brute strength, and while we know that Rhysand is physically lethal, the power we see him use most is his mind, and Rhysand seems to be the stronger of the two. And I thought it was a good way to show, like, the different... I don't think it showed, like, the whole spectrum of what masculinity could be, but I really like that it showed, like, very different depictions of what masculinity can be.
I agree with you, and I think it's important to note that they're both focused on strength, both focused on power, both focused on, like, leadership and being in charge. Yeah, which isn't necessarily exclusively masculine, but I think it is definitely a hallmark of out of alignment, like, abusive types of masculinity.
Definitely.
And another thing that Feyre does is she describes Rhysand as the most beautiful man I've ever seen, while Tamlin comes across as, like, hunky. What Rhysand reminds me of is actually a concept that I learned in my medieval literature class, okay, which I don't think I will ever say those words again. But it's this concept of sprezzatura, which is very common in the courts. And it's this idea that you have to, like, you act with this, like, grace, and it has to look completely flawless and natural. But in reality, everything is meticulously planned. Just the attention to detail, every single action is, you know how it's going to play out. You're gaming things. You're trying really hard to appear like things don't matter to you, or like everything's easy for you. But actually, it's a huge performance. And that's definitely how Rhysand comes across to me.
Yeah. If I picture Rhysand in my mind, he's like 100% my type. I think it's why I like him. Like, he looks like, I'm like, yeah, that seems about right. Like, he should be in a band.
Oh my God, he totally would have been in an emo band.
I know. And I'm like, oh, I love you.
It's both of our type.
I know. I really like him. But I also like this, like, I'm not a huge fan of Tamlin's, but I really like the, like, juxtaposition of the two. They're two very different fairies, males. I think that's what they say later, how they describe themselves.
Also another part of the binary, right? It's a male female, so it's kind of collapsing gender versus sex assigned at birth. Another thing that struck me was the patriarchal expectation that women should smile and laugh. Tamlin at one point asks Feyre if she even knows how to laugh on page 143. And I think that the book is almost trying to get us to, like, laugh at that, like, oh yeah, Feyre's so serious. But that just made me so mad. I was like, no, fuck you, dude. You're holding her hostage. She doesn't know you shit. And it just brought up the, like, don't tell me to smile. Ugh, no, just no.
But also, Tamlin is, like, kind of shitty about how, in the way he talks to Feyre about her life in the mortal realm, like, talking about how she lived in a hovel when that's obviously her home. Like, no reason to be shitty about it. Like, you know she's had a bad life. Of course she's pretty serious. She spent, like, the last 10 years trying to protect her family. What do you expect? Don't be shitty. Tamlin is a pain in my ass.
That's actually a really good segue to talking about class. I had way more observations about class than I was expecting. And so many feelings. One thing I think that the book does very effectively from the start is showcase the trauma of poverty and how it narrows the range of things a person cares about to the present moment and surviving until the next day. Or I should say how it can narrow the perspective in those ways because you're focused on material survival. Feyre says she can't remember the last time she, quote, bothered to notice anything lovely or interesting, end quote. I think that's page 3. But at the same time, this strikes me as problematic because it implies that people living in poverty can't experience joy or really have that much agency. People with material wealth don't have the monopoly on happiness or on joy. I don't know if you thought about this at all.
Maybe that's why we see, I know Elaine seems like kind of like not know what's going on, but maybe she's supposed to be like the opposite of that because obviously all three of the sisters and their dad are living in the same poverty. And I think it's harder on Feyre because she's trying to take care of everyone and make sure they survive. But we do see like Elaine is still able to feel happiness and see things that are beautiful. Like she's like, oh, I need a new cloak, and Nesta needs new boots, even though they're both kind of like, they don't, you know, they just want these things. So maybe we're supposed to see that as a way that like some people might feel this way about being in poverty, but other people, like, they don't have like the same feelings about it.
And Feyre's family was part of this wealthy bourgeois class of merchants, basically. And but then the creditors come calling and they lose all of their wealth. So this gives readers the sense that, like, there's some proto-capitalist economic system at work. And Feyre's parents seem to only care about their class status and riches and neglect their children. So just kind of like, I don't, just brought a lot up the beginning of the book, like how pathetic her father is because he lost his wealth and just like, ugh.
Her father was super frustrating for me, and he will continue to be frustrating through the rest of the books. Dude, get it together and protect your kids. And I would say that if he was a woman as well, like as a mom, you know, protect your kids. Like, why is he not doing anything?
Just parents. It just bothers me when we see a lot of narratives that talk about children having to take care of their parents,
right,
in ways that are like inappropriate. I don't know. There are ways when that seems like reciprocated, mm-hmm, or appreciated, but that was not the case in this novel.
No. And it was very frustrating for me. You talked about this a little bit, where right from the beginning we see the difference in socioeconomic class in the human realm. But we also, once we get to Prithian, we see the difference in socioeconomic class, and that becomes more intense, like the difference between like a high lord and someone like Alice. And maybe it's because the fairies have so much more, like the wealth seems like so much more in the fairy realm, that their differences in class are just like much bigger.
And I would say even moving beyond that, like, yes, and the difference between the High Lords and where Feyre comes from,
right,
like, that's just astronomical, mm-hmm, class difference. And this made me feel so many feelings, mostly rage, about capitalism and billionaires. I saw a tweet recently that put $100 billion in perspective. Did you see this?
I have not.
It's, if you save $50,000 a year for 20 years, you'd have $1 million. So you'd have to save $50,000 a year for 200 years to have $10 million. You have to save $50,000 a year for 20,000 years to get $1 billion. That is so fucked. It is absurd. And having that much, it's just, I just can't even, what? And I just kept thinking about this tweet when reading Feyre's reflections about Tamlin's immense wealth mostly, and about how the emerald curtains in her room could have fed her family for her life. And like Feyre, I was also disgusted. She explicitly uses the word disgusted about the wealth inequity.
Well, because they're so wasteful, too. She comes down to eat. She refuses to eat. And then the food just disappears. And then it comes back. And I assume that is different food. They're just so wasteful. They need to Marie Kondo and see what sparks joy and get rid of everything else.
And redistribute wealth.
Yes. Class in Prithian is especially apparent when we look at the relationship between Tamlin and Lucien, and when we think about the fact that we never see Alice interact with either of the men. So I don't think we see Tamlin or Lucien speak to someone who would be considered a servant once in the entire book. What the fuck is going on in this world with like these class differences?
Lucien explains the differences in magic between High Fae and what he calls Lesser Fae. He says, the High Fae don't have specific powers the way the Lesser Fairies do. I don't have a natural born affinity. And that's on page 88. And later he says, quote, we just exist to rule. And when you think about that, it's really fucked up. It's like some sort of social Darwinism about superiority. And even High Fae is capitalized in the text, versus Lesser Fairies is not. So we even see this hierarchy imposed at the level of language and capitalization.
And then later we see, as the story goes on and Feyre becomes like in love with Tamlin, she starts calling him my high lord. Like, she totally gives in to this like hierarchical bullshit. I'm like, no, don't do it. Don't fall for it. It's all a ruse.
Yeah, it's so hard to resist though, because it starts to look like the way things are,
right,
quote unquote, naturally. And like, if we get into, I'll link in the show notes to Capitalist Realism, this book by a guy named Mark Fisher from 2009. He talks about how the idea of capitalist realism is that capitalism starts to look like the only option. And it starts to look like the natural way,
right,
of things, when it's really not. Mm-hmm. And that's like, capitalism is so good at preserving itself because it crafts that narrative really, really effectively. It seems like a similar way that this sort of power structure is working in Prithian.
And I think that a little bit, maybe the people of Prithian, at least the High Fairies, don't understand that there is this like hierarchical divide, maybe, because Tamlin tells Rhysand that he doesn't enforce rank in his court. But that's obviously not true based on the way he treats not only Lucien, who is an emissary for his court, but Tamlin also demands certain things of his sentries, like sending them into the mortal world to die, and has all the Fae of the Supreme Court not talk to or interact with Feyre when she first arrives. So I think a little bit that the High Fae especially don't even realize this divide that they've created and maintain. And it's super frustrating.
They just don't see it. Don't interrogate it.
Obviously, the fairies can lie because that was a lie. Another thing that really pissed me off, Tamlin uses Feyre's family's health and well-being as a way to keep her from escaping. Tamlin, you can do better.
He literally threatens her that he's going to go back and stop taking... If she goes back, he's going to stop taking care of her family.
I was... Ugh. Tamlin, I hate you.
Ready to talk about race?
Let's do it.
First, I kind of want to start off saying that, like, I don't really know how to deal across the species line with race. I think it is a seeing the fairies versus the humans, you can read that as like racialization. But also we have different races within the Fae and within like specific sets of Fae, like High Fae versus Lesser Fae, and then within the High Fae themselves. So I'm just going to put that out there that, like, I don't really know what to do with that, and then just going to keep going.
All right.
The bloody history behind the creation of the Wall straddles these categories of race and class, which are, of course, obviously inextricable anyway. But throughout the novel, Feyre gets more information about Prithian's history and how oppressive the relationship between Fae and humans used to be, and, like, still is, honestly, but particularly in the past. The Fae enslaved the humans, and then the humans, with some Fae allies, revolted to gain their freedom. So there's a history of slavery going on. And then Feyre is surprised to learn that she's living in a house where there used to be enslaved people. And the reality is we're all living with the legacy of slavery and settler colonialism all the time.
Yeah. Something to also think about if you live in the South and you want to have, like, a plantation wedding, like, that place was built on the backs of Black people. Like, that one's a hard one.
Also, the White House was built by slaves.
Yeah. Like, so many of our structures. Well, it's a little complicated because it was her people who were enslaved.
That's true.
But she does. I mean, it's hard because Feyre doesn't have any like classical schooling. So she doesn't seem to know the history of her own people, which can be hard. Yeah, race is complicated in this book.
It's really complicated. We're probably going to fuck up. So hold us accountable, listeners.
Yeah.
I was also interested, you mentioned this a little bit earlier, about how the humans lose connection to religion and spirituality as a result of the wars with the Fae. Do you have any idea why that might be?
I think that it's like a difficult thing, and I know we put it in race, but it's a hard thing for me because I think of like how a lot of Black people are Christians, which is like not the religion of where they came from, like where their ancestors are from for the most part. And this makes more sense to me, like that you would, like as someone who was enslaved and who have like live in like these lower socioeconomic classes, and you just get so beat down, it would make sense to push religion like out of your life. Like that makes more sense to me than like becoming more religious, I guess. What do you think?
I mean, I can't speak to that sort of history.
Yeah.
Right. That's something I don't have access to, and I've, you know, don't have to deal with that sort of trauma, right? Because I'm white. But I don't know why it might be in this novel. I think that the war was just so traumatic, maybe, that humans didn't see why you would worship anymore. It seems like they used to have this sort of more pagan. Mm-hmm. They used to worship like the fairies did.
Right.
I don't really know the answer to that.
Yeah, because we also see like the Children of the Blessed, but they are kind of worshiping the Fae as if they were gods, I guess.
Yes, totally. And I think that's a really important point because the Children of the Blessed come in and they exploit humans' need for hope. Right. And they almost like see a niche in the market and create something to fill it. And it just really brought up a lot of feelings about how exploitative and predatory missionary religions can be.
Yeah, I didn't really think about that. And, you know, like my mental framework is framed around Christianity because it's what I grew up with. It's not what I practice, obviously. But when you think about the way like Christianity is meant to be like hopeful and like instill hope in you, like if you pray it hard enough, like things will get better, like those kinds of like narratives, it makes sense. I guess it does kind of make sense that it's so easy for people who are like downtrodden to take up those religions because they do prey on the fact that like things are bad for you. They could get better.
Yeah, they're almost selling something. But at the same time, like this is coming from two people who aren't religious. So I'm sure that someone else would have a completely different interpretation of the role that religion can play for a person.
Yeah. Just make sure you like research where your church's money is coming from.
And especially if you're a white person, don't go appropriating other traditions.
Yeah.
Stop that shit right now.
Agreed.
Feyre really seems to have deeply internalized the discourses of racial inferiority of humans when compared to Fey. It was really, really strong in her exposition. And humans supposedly are physically weaker, more ugly, and their senses are a joke in comparison to the Fey. The Fey have vastly more knowledge because they're immortal. And humans can never hope to accumulate that sort of knowledge and power. Plus, add on top of that, Feyre can't read. And she feels deep shame about that. But the book constantly disparages humanity. Did you notice this? Like this dynamic of racial inferiority versus superiority?
I didn't really think about it when I was reading.
It made me start wondering, what do humans have that the Fae don't then? And we see at the end of this book, it's the ability to feel. And don't, no, stop. Do not roll your eyes. Do not roll your eyes at me. Stop that right now.
I don't want feelings.
And Reese tells her, and there's a quote, "Be glad of your human heart, Feyre. Pity those who don't feel anything at all." And that's on page 414. And we keep seeing this again and again in the books we've been reading about how feeling is... Oh my, you stop. I can't tell listeners what, I can't describe what you're looking at me like you're disdainful. But I think it's a beautiful sentiment.
I know it is. Feelings are complicated and hard and I don't always like them. I get it. I guess if you live forever, it'd be a lot easier to become super cynical and like not want to feel your feelings because you probably have hundreds of thousands of years of emotional trauma and I wouldn't want to be dealing with that shit either. So good for Feyre, I guess. So race among the Fae. The people from the Summer Court are described as having mahogany skin. Do you think they're supposed to be POCs or are they really tan white people?
Some of the fan art I've seen does have them with very dark skin. So I think that's kind of influenced how I see it.
I literally looked up what the color mahogany looked like and I was like, this could either be a person of color or it could be kind of like what it looks like when a white person's like, I'm gonna get tan.
Which is funny that you say that because Tamlin also has, quote, sun-kissed skin.
Like, well, yeah, but I was just like, that's like what does that golden skin, yeah, exactly. White person talk for tan.
We do get some descriptions of skin color throughout the book, but none of the Fae with darker skin have speaking roles. So I think that's important to notice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't think about that. Except for like that blue-skinned fairy, but he's also literally dying.
I think we do get some
later.
Later, we'll have to talk.
Yeah.
Race will get interesting later, too.
Yes.
And along similar lines, what am I supposed to make of the fact that the, quote, high fae, the fairies with more power, higher class status, and racial privilege within fairy society are all beautiful and flawless? Their appearance is much more human-like. That's curious. And when they spend all their time talking about how low humans are and like they basically just look like super beautiful humans versus the lower class slash race fae who are described as more monstrous and usually have darker skin like blue skin, green skin, black skin, brown skin, bark. Like Alice has bark as skin. We've seen this in several other stories, especially like The Cruel Prince is the one that's coming out to me, but I don't really know what to do with this.
I don't know what to do with it either. As a person of color, I'm like, yeah, I don't know what to do with this. Because we also see it in things like Lord of the Rings where like...
Orcs.
Yeah.
Yurukai. Totally. Yeah. Yes.
And this is just from the movies, I should say. Like, I haven't read the books, so maybe it's different in the books. I don't know.
It's been forever since I've read those.
Yeah, I don't know what to do with it. I don't know.
I think it's good. We'll just put it out there on the table.
Yeah. Maybe we'll feel different and like more strong feelings about it when we get into the further books in the series when we see more different types of fae and actually diversity interact with them.
Yeah. More diversity. I just think that it'd be cool to find a narrative that takes this concept of beauty as needing to be human-like and turns it on its head. I don't think we've seen that yet.
No. And we actually haven't read any fairy stories with or by Black authors. We need to find those. And I don't think I ever have.
Commence the research.
So I saw this thing on Twitter recently about how often in fantasy, the creatures in the stories who have a diminished population and who are set up to be the quote unquote bad guys are often meant to depict how POCs are treated in real life. And then how that is not how we should be looking at other beings in these stories, as they are often the beings that actually hold the power in the fantasy stories. Like in this book, the Fae are the ones who have all the power, even though they're the ones meant to be scared of. And I really appreciated that when looking at us reading this book, a book that doesn't actually have possibly any POCs, because I'm sure some people may read this story as the fairies being subjugated to prejudice from the humans. But the issue here is that the fairies are feared because there are fairies like Amarantha, the Adder, the Naga, etc. And they're more powerful than the humans. And in the real world, POCs are not the ones who have power. So I think this gets complicated a little bit when we think about race in worlds where the beings opposite to the humans are, there are less of them so that they get depicted as people of color. And I don't really know what to do with this other than put it out there into the ether. That's all I got.
This doesn't really fit anywhere. So I'm going to say it now because it's our podcast and we do what we want. I think Feyre gives a good example of what an actual apology is and can look like. And so she says this to Tamlin. "I regret what I did to Andris. I regret that there was such hate in my heart. I wish I could undo it and I'm sorry." And then we should add that, like, the person would ideally go a step further and be like, "I'm committed to unlearning. I'm committed to doing better. I'm not going to make you forgive me or anything, or like make me feel better." Just expressing your regret and your apology and just like do it. Because I think in this time that we're in right now with hashtag Me Too, and also with the like governor of Virginia and his like racist yearbook photo, and just like
my home state,
people not knowing how to apologize and not knowing how to act when they're taken to task and people are trying to ask them to be held accountable for bad shit that they did in the past. And I think that we could all just like learn how to apologize and own our shit better, and then the world would be a better place.
Yeah. So often we get those apologies that are an "I'm sorry you feel that way" kind of apology. Even the governor of Virginia was like, "I'm sorry this made people upset." And I'm like, that's not an apology. Either you're sorry for what you did or you're not. And if you're not, don't even say it.
And also the fact that you like give a shitty apology doesn't mean that anyone has to forgive you or you should retain any of your power.
Yeah, exactly. He should step down. Also, I'm not real big on forgiving people, so I'm like, whatever, fuck off.
Right. You should apologize whether or not that person that you did it to is going to forgive you. Like, yeah, that shouldn't be the reason.
Right. I actually saw a really good interview yesterday on the show that I love called The Russell Howard Hour. But it was a man, his son had gotten stabbed because apparently knife crime is a really bad problem in England. But he talked about having to like forgive the person who killed his son so that he could like move on and help other people, which I think is a great sentiment to have. But I also think it's important to realize and acknowledge that everyone who asks for forgiveness doesn't have to be granted that forgiveness. Like, it's also important to remember the people who have wronged you so you don't let that happen again.
Absolutely. It's a protection mechanism. It makes absolute sense.
Yeah. Forgiveness is like a hard thing to like give to someone else. So if someone's willing to forgive you for something, like, you should be super thankful that they're willing to like trust you again. I say don't forgive and don't forget.
Finally, it's time for Shipwrecked, a segment about asexuality, sexuality, sex, romance, and relationships. And sometimes we take liberties and do some shipping of our own.
We finally get real sexy times.
Finally!
But for real. I can hardly talk about the relationships in this book because spoilers, but the sexy times we get in this book are not even as intense when compared to Akamath. So, like, prepare yourselves for when we get to it.
I'm going to make you talk about relationships spoiler free.
It's very difficult for me.
Sorry, not sorry. Feyre and her family. We'll start. I'll softball you.
Okay.
This is a really unidirectional relationship, and she gets nothing in return but feels a deep obligation despite the constant emotional abuse by Nesta and exploitation by everyone in her family. What did you think about the family dynamics?
The family dynamics in this book are so complicated, not even just in Feyre's family, but what we'll learn about future families and some of what we've learned about Tamlin not wanting to be the one to take power, you know, after his dad is murdered, killed, whatever. I have a hard time with this. As I think I've said before, I'm like not a very family oriented person. And if I was Feyre, I'd probably be like, peace out, bitches, figure it out on your own. Like, they don't care. Like, they don't want to help her. They're not like trying to protect themselves, or I don't know. Oh, her family's so frustrating. All of them. What do you think?
It strikes me as an abusive relationship, honestly.
Yeah. It's interesting to think about that because I think sometimes we forget, not we, you and me, but like we as a larger people forget that like neglect is a form of abuse. And her father is just, he's just sitting idly by doing nothing to help his children who, if Feyre didn't learn how to hunt for the family, they would starve to death.
Also, they neglected her because no one educated her right after they lost their wealth.
Yeah. And I know Feyre seems to hold like her sister's responsible for that because they did get an education, but her dad is also responsible for her education and well-being. He is the parent. He should parent.
Feyre and Tamlin. I think it makes a lot of sense why they get together. Because kind of coming off of the discussion about Feyre and her relationship to her family, she spent so long taking care of everybody and everything and getting no appreciation for it. So I imagine Feyre was exhausted and like fucking over it. Who wouldn't be? And then Tamlin comes along and provides and protects. So I think it makes a lot of sense, honestly.
I agree. I think part of the reason that Feyre falls for Tamlin is that he is constantly doing something to quote unquote save her, whether it's, you know, taking her from like this terrible situation she's in at home, providing for her family, saving her from the Nagat. Like, he's always doing something. And I'm just like, I get it, I guess, but it's also annoying.
What do you think about Beauty and the Beast? Heroine eventually falls in love with her kidnapper narratives.
We talked about this a little bit in Girls of Paper and Fire. It's like, it's hard because it's like one of those movies I loved as a kid. Like, I loved Beauty and the Beast and
also loved this live animation or live action remake.
Yeah, it was great. But honestly, I'm like, is this just Stockholm syndrome? Like, again, like with Girls of Paper and Fire, I don't know. I don't know.
I don't know either. It's one of those where I'm like, it's hard to know if I'm operating because of my programming,
right?
Like social programming, mm-hmm. or like what is appropriate and inappropriate. I mean, it's obviously not appropriate to kidnap people ever. This is one of those narratives. It's like an archetypal narrative,
right?
And but it's so rife with issues and problems.
Yeah, I don't know. The first time I read this book, and it's hard for me because this is a reread and I've read the whole series. But the first time I read this book, I was like totally on board. And I was like, yeah, this makes sense. Like, of course you would fall in love with him. Like,
yeah,
I like Tamlin.
He's hot AF.
Yeah. I mean, not in a way that I want, but like in a conventional way. I don't know. I like struggle with this when it's someone who's like been taken captive. I'm kind of like, ew, gross. Like, don't fall in love with that guy or girl or whatever.
It's just frustrating to me that it's always this narrative is always seems to be a person gendered like female, mm-hmm. who getting saved by a guy,
right?
And she has to forget all of the baggage that is inherent, right, in this power dynamic, right, that she is operating within, and just decides to go along with it.
Yeah, I'll link to it in the show notes. Well, you will, because you're doing this episode. But I did watch this show where this was like completely turned around, where this guy gets kidnapped because he refuses to do cancer treatment. He thinks he's going to heal his cancer like through juicing, and his friends kidnap him and like force him into cancer treatment. And he does not fall in love with his captors. He's super pissed with his friends in the end. And I was like, yeah, this is more normal. Like, you're not going to be happy when people kidnap you. Like, you're not going to fall in love with some, like, there's a girl that's, like, interested him with him in the show. And, like, you're not going to fall in love with them. They kidnapped you and are holding you against your will. And in this case, like, giving you medicine you don't want. So there is one instance where I saw this not play out in the usual way.
So Feyre and Tamlin are together. And Feyre's jealousy gets visceral when she thinks about Tamlin being with other lovers. And I'm always skeptical of any story that tries to get me to think of other women or, like, femme people as competition, whether that's for jobs, for partners, like, for anything. I think it's really important to unlearn this damaging programming foisted on us by patriarchy and capitalism and white supremacy and settler colonialism.
Yeah, especially when you think about it within the confines of, you have made no promises to each other. He's not tied to you in any way.
They haven't had a DTR.
Yeah, have the DTR, and then maybe you can be mad jealous if you want to be, but also maybe don't be with a partner you can't trust.
And also, like, jealousy is your own feeling.
Yeah, don't, like, voice that onto the other person.
I always, like, ugh, the hair stands up on the back of my neck whenever I can tell I'm trying to be manipulated to see other people as competition. I guess maybe that's just a thing that I'm trying to unlearn in my own personal life.
But it makes sense. I think it's something that we all should unlearn. There's just no reason. Like, you have to just, like, do what you have to do and, like, let everyone else live their life in non-harmful ways.
I'm curious what you think, because I sensed this, like, oppressive heteronormativity in the novel. What did you think?
I would agree. I think that this is so hard to do with no spoilers. Like, so hard.
Just talk about the present state of things.
I know,
the novel.
It's so difficult.
You can do it. I'll train you as a literary critic.
It's hard for me. No, I 100% agree. It just, Tamlin needs to protect people. Feyre can't do anything for herself. Like,
but at the same time, she really does.
Yeah, of course she does. But it's like, he doesn't want her to. Like, he doesn't even want to tell her what's going on so that she can, like, with the 3 days left, like, he doesn't even trust her to be able to stand up for herself. And in the end, she's, like, super badass and, like, does all these things and, like, gets through all the trials, even though she can't read. And, like, she doesn't, like, she's gone into, like, this manipulated bargain with Amarantha. Like, she can take care of herself, and Tamlin is a tool. Tamlin the tool.
I just couldn't with how heteronormative it is. It's just everywhere.
I think maybe where we see it the least is with Alice. She's taking care of her nephews, but she is not partnered in any way, shape, or form that we know of, and I don't think that we learn of in the future. Maybe she is just our lone person.
What do you think about mating bonds? I'm going to ask you before I say my piece.
Okay. I am a super cynical person, as you know.
I love that about you.
Thank you. But I get so wrapped up in, like, these, like, conventional, like, romance stories sometimes where I'm like, they're fated to be together. Like, they're the one. Like,
you're all Twitter-pated right now. I can see it.
And it's, like, a thing I find annoying in myself. Ugh.
So you're pro mating bond.
I like the idea of them, but it's also hard because, you know, I'm not, like, one of those people who are like, yeah, let's say something is fated, because I don't think it thinks through the repercussions of how that works.
Fate just kind of washes away all of the really complex dynamics that come into play before, like, a fated thing happens.
When it kind of takes away your ability to choose, which I don't like, but I'm just such a sucker for a romance story. I hate it about myself, so I'm just gonna be honest about it. Your thoughts?
As you can probably imagine, I am deeply conflicted about mating bonds. So Tamlin explains them. This might be helpful. Quote, high fae mostly marry, but if they're blessed, they'll find their mate. They're equal. They're match in every way. High fae wed without the mating bond, but if you find your mate, the bond is so deep that marriage is insignificant in comparison. It's on page 175. There are some downsides to this arrangement and risks associated. For example, Tamlin's mother does nothing to stop his father's horrific actions because they were mated and she like loved him too much or some bullshit like that. So like accountability, right? The ability to say, I would say that it's like conditional love, not unconditional, right? There are conditions if you are abusive, if you are literally enslaving other people and slaughtering them on a mass scale. Like there are conditions, I would say. And this mating thing makes monogamy seem like the only option. For me, it all comes down to choice. At this point in my life, I want to feel like choice is the most important part, and consent are the most important parts of what keep people together in a healthy partnership, and how that means that you can make that partnership whatever you want. It doesn't have to be monogamous or hetero or super conventional at all. There is no one way to be in a partnership with someone.
Right. And then the mating bond also kind of complicates how consent even works. If you have no choice in the matter.
Yes, totally.
And I think in future books, we get better depictions of how the mating bond can work. I think we see some better dynamics than Tamlin's parents in future books.
I agree with that. But at the same time, it's just like, I don't think I'm ever going to be able to resolve this like you.
No.
Like there are certain ships that I feel so strongly about and they're super normative and that's frustrating, right? But I still, they make me feel, Sarah J. Maas, you're making me feel so hard.
Yeah. I don't even know. I'm not on board for determinism, but whatever. I really love, I don't know. I can't deal with my own feelings right now.
One thing I appreciate immensely about ACOTAR and the series in general is that Sarah J. Maas does absolutely zero shaming of sex. Let it be known, hetero sex.
And we'll get a little shame in the next book, but only a small amount.
Right. But at least in this book, Feyre is sexually active when we meet her. She has sex because she feels like it. There's no discussion of her losing her virginity or how like important that's supposed to be as like a milestone. I think that this is the most open book that we've seen so far in respect to sexuality.
Yeah.
Well, heterosexuality.
Well, yeah, for sure.
Heterosex, I should say.
Yeah. Especially because oftentimes in books, both young adult and new adult books, the losing of your virginity is like the biggest deal in the entire universe. It's not. It's just sex. Like maybe it's more important to some people than others. And we see Feyre. I cannot remember the name of the dude she's like sleeping with at the beginning of the book.
Isaac?
Oh, yeah, Isaac. Like, he's the one taking contraception to make sure that they don't, like, accidentally have a baby because that's not something they want, which was also not something we see in books. Like, often men are not the ones who are
expected to do that.
Yeah, to be responsible. I really liked that, and I appreciate something that's more sex positive than some of the books that we've had in the past. Now we're going to talk about writing style, narration, characterization, plot structure, and basically whatever else comes to mind in a segment called Kill Your Darlings. I want to start with talking about how this book should not be classified as young adult. Kelly and I both read an article from Book Riot, which we'll link to in the notes, about how often fantasy books written by women are often placed in young adult, even when they have more mature themes.
Miscategorized, yeah.
I do think that it's purposeful because I do think young adult is often seen as something that is purchased by women of both like older women and younger women. And so they think that they can get more money out of it. So like hashtag capitalism sucks. And that's why they're doing this. But I, as a person who has no children and will not, but I don't think I would be comfortable giving this book to a 13-year-old. And part of the thing about young adult books is I think a teenager should be able to go into the YA section, like from the full spectrum of like what it means to be a teenager, and a parent should feel comfortable letting their kid read that book. And I would not let a 13-year-old read this book. It's super violent. Feyre is like literally killing people, killing fairies. And this isn't like the most graphic sex, but like this is a lot. I don't think 13-year-old me would have been comfortable reading this book. My parents would have had no idea because they didn't keep track of what I was reading, but
same here. I was totally reading content like this when I was like 11, 12, 13. Yeah. And that's because, I mean, I was a pretty frictionless child and mm-hmm. I just wanted books. And so my, like, no one paid attention to the books I was getting.
Same. Yeah.
I didn't read this book when I was that, this specific one. I just mm-hmm. read it last year, but I was reading stuff with this sort of content in my formative years.
Right.
And it's just such a tricky subject. Like, when, how are we supposed to decide as like a society what's mm-hmm. appropriate for different ages? Because, I mean, young adult, the teenage years span so many different experiences, right? At 13, it's so different than if someone's 18. And also those experiences are mediated through different identities,
mm-hmm.
right? I know YA tends to be typically a super whitewashed market. Mm-hmm. I think that's changing and has been changing in the past 5-10 years, specifically like recent past.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with you though that this doesn't seem appropriate for younger teens. Would you call it new adult then?
I personally think it should be categorized as new adult, especially because Feyre's not, I mean, she's a teenager in this book, but she's 19. She's like on the cusp of being out of her teenage years, which is something we also don't normally see in young adult. Normally the characters are the age of the people who might be reading the books.
Yeah, like 16.
It's hard because I don't really want a rating system on books like we have for movies. But if this was a movie, it would be rated R. And so I kind of feel like I don't know what the answer is, like how to fix it other than, one, this book should be categorized as for adults. But I don't know. I don't know how to fix it.
I also don't think that like sheltering mm-hmm. young people from sex and sex, especially like sex positivity, is the right thing to do.
Right.
That's just not the way to go about things. That doesn't, abstinence doesn't, like only education does not work.
It does not.
I mean, super heteronormative sex education is also not a thing that we should be doing. Or super transphobic sex education.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that access to this type of narrative can really like blow open a young person's views of what sex and sexuality are. Not sexuality, because this is super heteronormative.
Yeah.
There's no right answer, I don't think. But no. I agree with you that this isn't like young YA at all.
And it's hard for me because I worked in a public library and this book was in the YA section, which I get it. It's fine. So was Children of Blood and Bone. That is in YA. But the Mortal Instruments series was also in there. And I did have a mom ask me about the books and I was like, it's fine, but there is incest in this. So I don't know how you feel about that. And so I think it's hard because I think just by reading like the back panel of a book, you're not always going to know what it's about. I'm not a parent, so I don't know. And I don't know what I would do if I was a parent. I just have a cat, so like she can read whatever she wants. And especially when I start to think of like Acamath.
That's just straight up fantasy, like adult fantasy.
And when I think about like the sex scenes in those books, I'm like, they wouldn't put that in a movie. It's too much. Right?
I mean, not too much.
Okay, I don't think it's too much. I think it's great and it's a perfect amount, but like, they wouldn't put that on the screen, you know?
No. Yeah, you're right.
The problem is I don't want like super conservative parents being able to tell their kids what to read. And that's like where I'm like, no rating system. Like, they should be able to read stuff. But I think I've also seen in the public library, like 13-year-olds checking out 50 Shades of Grey. And I'm like, do you need a parent there to like talk to you about like, I don't know.
I think maybe it would depend on how open or what that person who is reading this, if they're a young person,
right.
If they have access to someone who would have open discussions with them about sex and sexuality.
And I think so many kids don't, because I was reading books with sex in them when I was young and like no one was talking to me about it.
Mm-mm.
So then your ideas of sex and sexuality are so formed by these things that you're reading.
Like what we hear about with porn.
Yeah, exactly. And I worry about people, like what they think is normal, not normal, based on like the kind of books they have access to.
Which that actually brings me into the next point that I wanted to make in Kill Your Darlings, which is the cliches and the actual sex scenes, like actually talking about the language.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to just throw some words out. Okay.
Okay.
Feasting, fractured, sheathed, splintering around him, and went over the edge. I mean, like, please. Also, scenes like this are going to try and make you think that the one thrust orgasm is a thing. It isn't. Well, I mean, I think that's like a pretty okay thing to say. It's not really.
No, I'm not in my experience.
And furthermore, sex scenes and like cis heteronormative society more generally operate under the assumption that that orgasms are the be all end all of sexual pleasure.
Right.
And like a note here that asexuality is real and this isn't true for everyone.
Right.
And asexuality is a really like a really complicated spectrum also.
Mm-hmm.
And I just so this like gets to our point about whoever's reading this needs, if they're young, needs to be able to have conversations about what the narratives that they're being given about sex,
right,
and about sexuality, because it's like a very romanticized view. And I guess I'll put some educational reading about orgasms in the show notes.
Yeah, I think that is like super tied up in the YA thing, because I think for me, I think of like 50 Shades of Grey. I haven't read it, so let me just put that out there. But I know it deals a lot with like BDSM, which I don't know a lot about, but I've heard people in that community don't like that book because of its depictions of BDSM. So I worry about what like young people will think is normal, even in like different sexual communities. I don't know. Like, who do you talk to about that stuff? I mean, I guess hopefully you have a parent or an adult who's willing to talk to you about those things. Also, if you want better descriptions of sex without like these euphemisms that I'm not a fan of, read some more new adult books. They're great. I've read lots.
I loved Mass's treatment of music in her writing. The drums on Kalamai, the band playing on Summer Solstice, was that when it was?
Yeah.
And then also especially the scene where the music is playing in Feyre's head when she's locked in the cell under the mountain. The scene is just like so moving and transcendental. And I think some of Moss's best writing that we see in this book in particular. Now feast your ears on this lengthy quote. The music folded over itself like batter being poured from a bowl, one note atop another, melting together to form a whole, rising, filling me. It wasn't wild music, but there was a violence of passion in it, a swelling kind of joy and sorrow. The music built a path, an ascent founded upon archways of color. I followed it, walking out of that cell through layers of earth, up and up, into fields of cornflowers, past a canopy of trees, and into the open expanse of sky. I wanted to fade into it, wanted the light of the sun to burn me away, to fill me with such joy that I would become a ray of sunshine myself. This wasn't music to dance to. It was music to worship, music to fill in the gaps of my soul, to bring me to a place where there was no pain. It's on around page 373, 374, and I skipped around a little bit when I was quoting. It's good writing.
It is. And it becomes so much more significant in the next book.
It does.
So because I know, I'm like, oh, this is beautiful.
And also I like the synesthesia, the association of like music with sound, with color or texture. And I was curious if there are any pieces of music that make you feel like this when you hear them.
You know, I get like chills when I see like a band performing live that I really love. And it makes me feel like, I don't know, like emotional in that moment. I've seen My Chemical Romance like 4 times, and I feel it every time I see them because they're the best band of all time, and I will die on that sword. What about you?
For me, they are Massenet's Meditation from Thai and also the Miserere, which is a choral piece that's only sung specifically in the Sistine Chapel. And yeah, I mean, like, there's a lot of problems with my choices. They're super white examples, but like, I guess I'm super white, so it makes sense. Yeah, I just, music.
It's great. It brings us together.
Recommend if you like badass female protagonists.
I can't say enough good things. Like, there are obviously super problematic things with these books, with all of Sarah J. Maas's books. But I just love them. They're so good.
I adore them so much.
You know, I think she writes really good characters. Her characters feel like both universal and like different from other characters that we read in YA that I'm just like, I'm hooked.
There are tropes, but it doesn't seem tropey. I just read these, everyone.
Before we end, it's time for real talk. Did reading this book make your perspective change in any way? Or did it make you interrogate a concept / system / trend you hadn't before? So, Feyre is willing to see the best in Tamlin, Even when Tamlin sits idly by while Amarantha is torturing her and all of Prithium. I know that when I first read this, I didn't really see this as much. I was just seeing like Tamlin in pain and yada, yada, yada. But love can make it difficult to understand that a person you love is selfish and unwilling to make sacrifices, even when it's in your best interests or in the interest of others. Love can make it difficult to see another person's faults. I know this is super cynical, but that's who I am. And this book kind of reminded me, like when we read Mortal Instruments, that like quote, like to love is to destroy. It brought that back up for me a little bit to think of like how love can be so encapsulating that you're like ignorant to the red flags. What about you?
My contribution to Real Talk is a question.
Okay.
Throw it back at you.
Okay.
What would you do with your time if you were in Feyre's situation, stuck in Prithian with nothing to do?
I thought about this all morning and I came up with a really good plan. I would force Tamlin to bring me all the homeless cats and I would create a cat sanctuary in the spring court because the cats would love it. It's super warm out. They can play with like butterflies flying around. I would take care of them and knit and read all day.
I'm imagining like a Lisa Frank poster.
Yeah, basically that would be my life. And I'd be super happy and I would tell Tamlin to fuck off and leave me alone. Like, build me a cottage somewhere else. I don't want to have to see your ugly face again. That would be it. What about you?
I would probably read a lot.
Of course.
No one's surprised by that. Yeah, I would just want to learn stuff.
You'd have that whole library, which would be great.
I would want to travel. Maybe I'd learn how to do some stuff like hunt and things. Like how to actually fend for myself. I'd learn how to fight. I'd get probably super ripped. I'd spend a lot of time outside. That would be beautiful to be in the spring court all the time. You could just be outside and in the gorgeous scenery.
Feyre does say she gets tan while she's there. Because I was like, maybe no sunburn, but like, I guess Tamlin could heal you. That seems like a good way to spend your time.
I don't have as good an answer as you.
I really like thought about it for a long. My like dream is to like open a place where I can like help save cats because I love them so much.
Before we end, we're going to talk about ACOTAR and how it relates to the rest of the series in a segment called A Court of Secrets and Spoilers. You've been warned. This is the segment where there's going to be a lot of spoilers of the rest of the series. So if you haven't read the series / don't want spoilers, skip this part of the episode, please. And we'll be back in a fortnight with episode 15 about the Poppy War by R.F. Kuang.
Okay, I'm so excited to talk about
this. Oh my god,
spoiler.
I'm so ready. It's been so hard. I think we kind of, like, we haven't been the best.
Okay.
But it's okay.
We did pretty good. Do you want to start with talking about Amarantha and Rhysand?
Oh yeah, we should. The situation between Rhysand and Amarantha is just so tragic. It's sex slavery. And it's so, I don't even know if there are words to describe how awful this is.
Yeah. It only gets worse because we learn so much more in Acamath about how terrible it was for Rhysand that it like breaks my heart. And I know I don't like to feel my feelings, but I'm like, every time I read it, I'm like, ugh, poor Rhysand.
And I don't think we get a lot of narratives that go into like heterosexual relationships where the man is the person who is being raped or abused.
And that's what this is. I mean, it is rape. And it's, oh my gosh. Every time. It gets me every time. On page 101, Lucian is talking about Tamlin killing those who disobey him, and he says, "You don't hold on to power by being everyone's friend, and among the fairies, lesser and high fae alike, a firm hand is needed. We're too powerful and too bored with immortality to be checked by anything else." I had kind of forgotten how violent Tamlin is, and when we see the way he rules compared to Rhysand in future books, we see how Tamlin's mistrust and violence make him susceptible to manipulation, and how this is not the only way to rule immortals. Something I noticed on every chapter, you read the ebook?
I did.
Are there like little thorns at the beginning of each chapter?
There are not.
So this is a court of thorns and roses, but we never get a depiction of any roses. And I'm interested to see how this will change in Acamath, if the pages have something else on them or if that changes as we go through the books. Because like, obviously the spring court is super terrible, and like Rhysand's gonna come and take her away, and I can't wait.
I'm excited for my box set to get here. It gets here soon.
Oh yeah, so exciting. I also like want to read Akamath right now because I'm like, can I just get to the part where she gets to be with Rhysand now?
Totally.
So excited. So part of me thinks that if Tamlin had been honest with Feyre about Calamai, he might have kept her from meeting Rhysand so early. But maybe that wouldn't have helped. I couldn't decide if maybe the mating bond is what actually gave Feyre the irrepressible urge to go to the celebration at Calamai. What do you think?
Or when he says, I've been looking for you. There you are. I've been looking for you. Like, be still my heart.
I know.
I cannot handle it. I can't handle it.
I just remember him like telling her about that in the next book. And I'm
I need to go back and I'm excited to read Akamath because then you hear, like you hear it from Rhysand's perspective. I think the mating bond is in play. I think it's like a subtle, it's subtly in play and then snapped into place. And what we're going to talk about that right now.
Yeah. So when I first read this book the first time, when Rhys disapparates mid-sentence, like when he's leaving under the mountain, I was so sure Feyre and Rhysand had made it. I was like, can't wait.
I had literally no idea, like in caps, had no idea the first time I read this book. I was like, oh, that's kind of weird. They were having this like really nice, vulnerable, open conversation. And then he just leaves. I figured something happened. But then this is the first time I've reread the book. And so knowing what this scene means in the scope of the entire series, I went back and reread it like 12 times. I read this scene like 12 times in a row. I'm not kidding. And just, it's like so transcendental. So as much as I like have problems with a mating bond, like this scene is just so well written and like masterfully situated within the overarching series narrative. It's just like so, so good. This is Sarah J. Maas at her best right here.
I 100% agree. Oh, I'm just like so excited for Rhysand and Feyre to be together and for everything to be happy again.
Oh my God. Faysand is one of my OTPs for sure.
And now I can say that I want fanfic, Nesta and
Cassian.
Yes.
There is so much Nessian fanfic out there.
I'm sure there is. I'm just too lazy to look for it.
It's good. It's a lot of like love hate stuff, which can be like weird.
I'm here for it. I love enemies.
It's like
lovers.
Hate sex.
That's fine. I'm fine with that. It's fine.
They're both consenting.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course. So then it's okay.
But anyway, Faysand. I love this ship so much. And it's just such a slow burn.
Yes.
That really makes you wait for it.
It might be my favorite ship. I remember reading ACOTAR and it like kind of took me a while to get through because it gets kind of boring in the middle. Not that much is going on and she's just like hanging out at the Spring Court. And when I read the second book, I like flew through it. I maybe read it in like 2 days because I was just like, oh my gosh, I can't believe all this is happening. This is so exciting. Whew, it was great.
Oh my God, I can't wait.
I know.
It's just so, so good. I haven't been this Twitter-pated about a book in a long time. I'm curious, when did you start getting a bad feeling about Tamlin? Like, try and think back to the first time you were reading this.
I honestly think that it was when he didn't try to save Feyre at the end of the book. It was such a weird thing for him to just be sitting there staring as, like, Amarantha is literally torturing Feyre. She's killing her. And Rhysand risked his life and his court in an attempt to save Feyre. And I think some of that is the mating bond. Like, he can't help but want to protect his mate. But Tamlin is the worst. And I am so glad to know that he gets what's coming to him in the future. I know Tamlin doesn't think he gets what he deserves, but he is a great depiction of all the things that are wrong with white men who believe they deserve the world and everything they want just for simply existing. Fuck Tamlin.
Metaphorical. Mic drop.
Yeah. What about you?
Looking back, I was definitely on board with the Tamlin Feyre ship, but same. I wasn't like 100% like loving it. Mm-hmm. Especially, I started on the second reread. I started marking red flags while I was reading it, like Tamlin never explaining things to Feyre, just like keeping her in the dark, keeping her ignorant in order to like keep her subservient, essentially, and then also ordering her around. She has to obey, and that shit drives me up the fucking wall. Just so. Manipulative and it's just like the power dynamics are just so off kilter and unacceptable.
Right.
I agree with you. Fuck Tamlin. And I'm going to do an asterisk as I do as I do. But at the same time, I'm glad that Feyre had her experiences with him, because it's the first time she actually gets to focus on herself instead of constantly, you know, making a martyr of herself for others who don't appreciate her efforts, like her family, and how she kept them alive for like 10 years or 8 years or whatever. And Feyre even mentioned feeling free. She uses that specific word, free, for the first time in her life when she's with Tamlin in the Spring Court. And I think that's actually really incredible. And TBH, the situation with Tamlin did open up the horizons of possibility for Feyre within her relationship to herself, which I don't think that she had previously, like before she was in this relationship with him. And she gets to grow as a character. She gets to fuck up and change her mind. And I think that's great. I don't really want characters who don't change. That said, I'm excited that Feyre gets to have like a true partnership with Rhysand.
Right. And I guess technically, like if she hadn't have been with Tamlin, she wouldn't have become Fae. And then she would have had, you know, 70 years with Rhysand as she got old and he didn't, which is like not the biggest deal in the world. But also like, I get it. So, I mean, without all the Tamlin bullshit, she doesn't become Fae.
And I like that it's not our character meets their one true love and like right. They're not supposed to have sex with other people ever or have like ever experienced feelings about others. It's just so not like a Bella Edward Twilight narrative. Like, ugh.
Right.
I really like that we don't see her getting shipped with the first person that she right. falls in love with.
And we don't get those stories very often. Also, I'm sure we'll talk about this when we read Akamath, but Rhysand doesn't hold it against her either that she had this relationship with Tamlin. And like, I really appreciate that because we often see people in these books holding like earlier partners or whatever against the other person.
At the end of the day, there's really no comparison, Rhysand, Tamlin. Your point that he was fighting, he wanted to be on the right side of history with her, just like he has greater purpose, and Tamlin doesn't seem to have that really. And when he tells her, when they're on the balcony together, Rhys tells her that I didn't want you to fight alone or die alone, just like, oh my god.
And he doesn't even know she had that experience with the fairy, like, and who died, and how she thought like I wouldn't want to have died alone. He just gets her, and I love it.
It's just like the OTP for sure.
Yeah, agreed.
I'm really curious and looking forward to rereading the other books in the series because I can already tell that the narrative tries to go back and give the reader this sort of like revisionist version of what's been happening the whole time to Feyre to justify the shitty things that Rhysand did. For example, reading Feyre's mind and making fun of her sexual thoughts about her partner.
And himself, which I don't remember from the first time.
Yeah. And then also objectifying her in front of hundreds of Fae, saying things like, I don't like my belongings tampered with to her. And then also making her drink fairy wine, which she doesn't seem to like consent to. So I'm just going to put it on the table. I'm observing that my prediction is it's going to feel a little bit manipulative.
Oh, I think it does for sure. Because there was like this scene when he's like making the bargain with Feyre about staying with him. And he like kind of like pushes the bone even further into her. Like,
oh, yeah. I forgot about that.
Yeah. And I had forgotten about it as well because I haven't reread this book in a while. But I kind of forgot about the ways that Rhysand had like hurt her in the past and how we kind of forget about that in the books that come afterwards. So yeah, I think we're being manipulated a bit, but I mean, it's for the greater good, so like, whatever.
Thanks for listening to JK It's Magic. We'll be back in 2 weeks for a discussion of The Poppy War by R.F. Kuang. And watch out for the occasional minisode about a range of fantasy-adjacent topics. You can find us on Instagram and Twitter at JKMagicPod. Post or tweet about the show using the hashtag CriticallyReading. Do you have an idea for our miles-long TBR list? Email us at jkmagicpod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your suggestions.
Know a friend who would enjoy the podcast? Please spread the word. You can subscribe to JK It's Magic on the podcast app of your choice. And if you're feeling benevolent, we'd really appreciate it if you would rate and review the show.
Please do.
JK It's Magic is recorded on lands traditionally belonging to Cheyenne, Ute, and Arapaho Native people. Until next time, stay magical. Thank you. Time to talk about all things work.
Two for two.
That's a third one. All right.